Thanks, Lucy. A bit broader question. I'm John Horan from, I do a lot of work in the not-for-profit sector as well as government. A bit broader question. I'm very interested to understand as someone in Reserve Bank from Canberra what the relationship between business confidence, business investment, unemployment and interest rates are, and whether you see them triggering, over the last 4 or 5 years, the Reserve Bank seems keen to raise them, whether you see an optimum level of all those four things that you guys would measure that you'd be aiming for to keep the financial market stable.
Thanks very much for the question. Actually, we're in Sydney, so that's the first part of my answer. The second one is the board actually made a decision about the level of interest rates yesterday, and they went through in some detail their decision in the form of a statement by the governor. Next month there will be a statement on monetary policy that will be 60-odd pages chock-filled with my colleagues in the economic group's view about these things. I think, I'm not going to talk about monetary policy, so if you have a question about where interest rates are going, pick another one. obviously the variables that you've mentioned are all important parts of the way we read how the economy operates, but the Reserve Bank hasn't been given a specific target for business confidence or business investment. These are part of our information set, and the target that we've been given is actually the inflation target. So keeping inflation between 2 and 3% on average over the cycle. In fact, just on Friday, the government and the Reserve Bank released a slightly updated version of the statement on the conduct of monetary policy, and that basically goes through the whole thinking about what we've been charged with doing. So I hope that answers your question.
Dr. Ellis, my name is Martin Brown. I represent a small Australian manufacturer. Subject to fairly intense competition from some American manufacturers at the moment. What's the current outlook for Australian manufacturing given the high Aussie dollar and all of that for the future?
Thanks very much for the question. And as I did mention, I'm the head of financial stability, so really many of these questions are better directed to my colleagues in economic group. But I think what I can say about the exchange rate is that, it's set in a market. It's the result of what many people want to do with different currencies. And of course, every exchange rate is the exchange rate between two currencies. So you mentioned that you are competing quite substantially with American manufacturers, and of course, the U.S. economy is in a terrible state. There's a question of whether the Australian dollar is high or whether the U.S. dollar is low, and there's no way you can actually answer that on the basis of an exchange rate. Certainly, on a trade-weighted basis, the exchange rate in Australia is higher than average, but it's roughly the same level it was in 2008. And so I guess given that you're primarily competing with the U.S., it's not surprising that an economy that's had the kind of travails that the U.S. economy has done has got a low exchange rate. It's got low interest rates because its economy is so weak. And because its labour market is in a parlous state at the moment, its wages have been very weak as well. So the fact that they're able to compete with those extra boosts is not that surprising, but I guess you've got to answer once things start to pick up there and their dollar starts to recover versus some other currencies like our own, once their wages start to pick up again, well, then that's part of the transmission mechanism and part of the adjustment. And so I think you'll see that artificial boost, or that temporary boost will presumably dissipate.
Dr. Ellis, Robert Innes, I have my own business. You mentioned about roadmaps and stability and markets and setting criteria for policing those markets. Mm. One of the problems in the United States, especially with the subprime, some of that actually started from governments where they basically, Clinton basically said, we want more domestic lending to sort of different levels, First Mac, My brother-in-law actually sort of works in the banking sector in the United States, and the uncertainty sort of, especially at Goldman Sachs, is fairly high at the moment. But if we're going to set a roadmap for sort of business markets, really we've got to be very careful about governments sort of changing the rules as we go along for domestic policy. Would you agree?
Thanks very much for the question. Just to address the first section first, in fact, if you can stomach it, I actually wrote a paper on the US housing market and why it went completely pear-shaped when I was at the Bank for International Settlements. So if you Google my name, I'm not the British woman who's an Eskimologist student in some university in Denmark. I'm the other one. And it's actually the advantage of having an unusually spelt name. You can actually Google me and you can find that you know, US housing meltdown and my name, you'll find the paper. So you've probably asked the one person in this country who could answer that question in depth. And look, it wasn't, I mean, quite frankly, the desire to expand home ownership was an equal opportunity bipartisan policy in the US. I mean, we can't blame one president or the other. And in fact, many of the policy changes that came about to then boost the subprime market were actually, you know, they were actually quite recent policy changes. People were worried about the market power of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are lenders to the prime market, and they wanted to encourage an alternative, and so they brought in the subprime market. And I think it's no surprise to a Queensland audience, you know, you have this problem and you bring in this other thing and it becomes a bigger problem. So the US subprime lenders were the cane toads of the US mortgage market, and so we ended up with this bigger problem. But it was really, there was this bipartisan view of policy there that we wanted people to get into home ownership. They had this idea that if you owned your home, you'd behave better and mow your lawn. And so they really wanted to encourage that. And they did that by just encouraging more lending without really thinking too much about the lending standards. And, I mean, if you knew what I knew about just how ridiculous the lending standards got in the US mortgage market. I mean, people talked about ninja loans, no income, no job or assets. You didn't. The documentation standards were non-existent. And now that these houses are being foreclosed upon, we're actually discovering that there was extremely lax practices in terms of working out who actually was the lender. Because you could buy, you know, different institutions were buying and selling the mortgages between each other and packaging them up into structured finance securities. And sometimes the documentation didn't sort of come along. And so now it's in certain cases, there are problems working out who's actually allowed to foreclose. And so you've just had this huge logjam. But it was a bipartisan problem that built up over a number of years. In terms of the regulatory environment, the second half of your question, look, I agree. There's just so many different changes that are happening in response to the crisis and trying to fix things up better. There, of course, in any big complex change, there is a risk of unintended consequences, that this policy on its own might seem like a good idea and that policy on its own might seem like a good idea, but you put them together and it doesn't look so good. What I can do is reassure you that risk is front of mind in the international policy community. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so hard to come up with all these different rules and design the new Basel III rules and all of these things is to actually think through, well, what are the knock-on effects going to be? What are the effects on business confidence, on credit availability? And so we have to think through all those things, and, you know, we have to think through all those things jet-lagged. So it's a real issue, but I can assure you it's front of mind when we're having those discussions.
Hi, Dr. Ellis. Angela Harper from Australian Associated Press. I actually have three questions, but I'm sure you'll answer them very quickly. There's a paper put out by the RBA saying that you know, there's been very strong capital growth in recent years, particularly in Melbourne, in the housing market. But the recent slowing in price appreciation is a welcome development for the resilience of household finances, the document says. So does the low level of rental yields imply there's a limit to the rate of price appreciation in the years ahead? My second question is, does the relatively high debt levels of households have the potential to exacerbate the severity of future recessions? And my third question is, what do you think of the move by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner to monitor the ratio of females on boards starting next year?
Thank you, Angela. You've just asked me three questions on two of my favourite topics. I can actually bang on about housing for hours, but I won't because I have to catch a plane. So the first question was whether a low level of rental yields is a concern and might suggest that there's a limit to how far house prices could grow from here. And I think that the short and simple answer is, roughly speaking, yes. I mean, if rental yields are very low, that's an indicator that people are buying properties without thinking of, investors in particular are buying properties without really thinking about the rental yield. They're thinking about, they're buying with the purely with the anticipation of capital growth. And buying an asset because you're expecting its price to rise in the future, well, that is actually the academic definition of a bubble. So that would be undesirable and it would be seen as a problem. I should mention that rental yields have actually come up a bit lately. So, we see the levelling off in housing prices as being desirable in the sense that, we don't see that housing prices need to get back to their 1970s levels the way some commentators seem to have fixed in their minds, but they can't go onwards and upwards faster than income forever. And what we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years is that housing prices have, roughly speaking, tracked household incomes reasonably well, and that's more or less what you'd expect without major structural change of the kind that we saw in the 1980s and 1990s when you had deregulation and disinflation. Your second question, you could just remind me, was, household debt, that's right. So the level of household debt. Now, household debt did increase a lot over the 1990s and early 2000s. And as we said in the Financial Stability Review, which is the document you're referring to that we released last week, it's true, household debt in Australia has come up quite a lot, and it does seem quite high. It's not actually the highest in the world. Denmark, for example, has a ratio of about 300% to disposable income, according to my staff are telling me. We're trying to make sure that the number's comparable, but roughly speaking, there are a number of European countries that have much higher household debt-to-income ratios than in Australia. And the important point to mention is that there isn't actually any cast-iron law or equilibrium level about an aggregate debt-to-income level. It might be, for an individual, there's sort of a safe amount of debt that they can borrow given their income, the variability of their income, given the average level of interest rates over the term on which they're borrowing. But you're then adding that up over a whole bunch of different people who are very diverse and have different life experiences and different income levels and different ages and age distributions. And so there isn't anything actually in economic theory that would say that that has to be a magic number forever. It's actually this aggregation of many different decisions. And so there are times when the maximum safe level and that is a different level than what it was in the past. And that's what we've seen in Australia. And again, we have seen some levelling out in the household debt to income ratio at the aggregate level recently. One of the other things we also have mentioned in the last, both in the Financial Stability Review and in some other of our public documents, is that actually a lot of that increase in debt more recently has been in older households. So instead of paying off their mortgage by 45, they've still got one at 55. And so it's increasing the debt most amongst the people who've got the least risk and the lowest gearing. That seems to be what's happening based on the figures we have available. And the third question was about the Sex Discrimination Commissioners are concerned about the gender balance within various industries. And, of course, I am an economist and it is a fairly male-dominated industry. My head of communications is probably going to kill me for this one. But actually, this sort of doesn't bother me because, when I was 6 or 7, my dad's idea of babysitting was to take me to his wargaming club on a Saturday afternoon. And so I'm actually really used to being the only woman in a room full of slightly nerdy, very intelligent men. And so nothing's really changed. But on a serious note...
That's the one they'll quote, though.
Yeah. But on a serious note, I think one of the things I really like about working at the bank and admire about my colleagues is that it's very much a merit-based organisation. Yes, there are no women at assistant governor level or above, but 4 of the 12 people at department head level, including me, are female. So, sit back and wait. Maybe something will change one day.